Blog Talk Radio. Sorry, this is Dave Weiner, and we're doing a hopefully a reboot of the Rebooting the News podcast. I'm sitting here in New York City at NYU with Jay Rosen.
Hi, Dave. Welcome to NYU.
Thanks. So if you can actually hear what we're saying this week, it's because we're actually using a professional recording studio.
Yeah, and we're face-to-face the old-fashioned way for Rebooting the News number 38.
So, Jay, do I look like what I sound like?
Actually, I prefer listening to you and imagining what you're... Yeah, there's, you know, that the magic of radio is partly that there's no visual.
True.
But we're gonna work on this.
We'll muddle through somehow. Yeah. We'll get through this. Yeah. There's no latency here, by the way. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
You can actually hear what you're saying.
So exactly.
And see it.
And we can invite guests in here, which would be kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Too.
So let's get to some of the news that's happened since our last Rebooting the News, which was back in December before the new year.
That was last year.
Yeah. Uh-huh. For one thing, there was a big announcement out of NYU that Dave Weiner is going to be a visiting scholar at NYU's School of Journalism or Institute of Journalism and a technical advisor to Studio 20. So I'm really excited about that.
Thanks, Jay.
It coincides with you deciding to move at least half-time to New York City. And why don't you just explain to the people who follow our show why you decided to make this move to New York and maybe a little bit about NYU as well.
Well, I've always wanted to live in New York. You know, I grew up here and, you know, you put these things off and then time passes and all of a sudden, you know, it's like just some point you have to do it. If you want to do something, at some point you actually have to do it. So it feels like there's just a lot of pull to New York, too. I've always seen myself at least part of the media industry as much as I'm part of the tech industry. Mm. And I think that it's a time for change in the media industry, and I think this is a good place to be right now. As far as why NYU, well, this may make you blush, but I think that because you're at NYU, Jay, that, you know, NYU has a perspective on journalism that is pretty unique. So it's...
Well, that's cool.
Yeah. So we agree on a lot of things. We disagree on some things, but...
Yes, we do.
But I think that the basic premise that that the reboot has already begun. And, you know, I wrote a piece when we announced this. I wrote a piece called, I think, The Year Zero for Journalism.
Year Zero for Journalism. Really a great post.
Thanks.
I loved it.
Well, it was meant to be a little bit dramatic and sort of get you thinking.
It had some drama. Yeah, it had some dum-dum-dum to it.
Right. It's to think about that, you know, journalism isn't over just because it's going through a radical shift. Mm. It actually, in some ways, I think journalism is just getting started. So that's kind of where I want to be. I like to be at the start of things, and I, you know, I enjoy that, and I like the opportunity to be creative, and so that's why.
Yeah. The critic Roland Barthes was once asked why he liked to write fragments, little short pieces that were maybe a page long.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, because starting things is the most fun. So if you write short little things, you get to start and keep starting over and
I've
over.
I've heard that.
Yeah. But I'm with you. Starting things is fun because you don't know where they're going to wind up, and so life is unpredictable. Well, the reason I'm excited to have you is that journalists have to master tech more than they did before.
Mm.
In a world where technology is shifting a lot and where power is shifting because of technology, they can't just use it. They have to be in on it. And what I'm hoping is that the students who come here to learn about innovation in journalism absorb some of that perspective. Also, I'm trying to teach the students in Studio 20 that they can be the change. They can start things mm-hmm. themselves. Not just start sites, start companies, that's part of it. But you can also start movements and start doing things that other people can pick up on.
How's that going? How do they respond to that?
Well, I think they're still getting their minds around it. They're still learning that that you don't have to wait. You know, this is like a big philosophy of mine
with
students. You don't have to wait to be an innovator. You don't have to wait to build something new. You can start doing it now. And so just by absorbing what people like yourself do, they will get that message. You don't have to push them in a particular direction. You just have to kind of do it yourself and allow them to pick up on it. And so that's what I'm hoping you'll help us do.
Well, I also hope that other techies, you know, sort of get sort of in the loop or get close to what you guys are doing here.
Yeah.
Because you can flip it around. You can look at it from the other point of view and say that in order to do a really good job of developing some new technology, what you need is you need to have some users around who aren't just sort of being hypothetical about how they might use your product. A lot of times the feedback you get from people is very hypothetical or one level removed. They say, well, I understand what you're doing, but I don't think everybody else will. That kind of feedback's not very useful. The kind of feedback that's useful is, I would be able to use this product in a whole new way if you just added this one feature to it.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the things that you're looking for. And so whenever you have a convention as a convening of people who are trying to do something new with technology, that presents an opportunity for technologists not just to create something new, but also to learn the process of creating new things, because this is something that technology education doesn't really address. It doesn't really teach people how to innovate, how to create something new.
Mm.
They more sort of teach you the method. It's probably a lot like journalism school in that they teach you, and that, not to say that there's not a lot of value in learning sort of the classic, what we call algorithms.
As there's value in learning the classic routines of journalism.
Exactly. You know. But there's the level up is, well, how would you, what if there was no algorithm that allowed you to do this, how would you approach that problem?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's somebody approaches that. Somebody, you know, you would never have anything new if there wasn't a process to that. And that's my experience is that there is very much a process to creating new technology.
Mm.
And so that's something that's not only worth doing, but it's also worth studying and understanding. And so think of it as like a lab environment that goes, that it's interdisciplinary. It works equally well from both sides of the equation.
Exactly. Yeah. And one of the things I'm most excited about this semester is we have in my Studio 2 class, which is a graduate class, two students who are computer science majors.
Awesome.
Mixed
That's
in
great.
With the journalism students.
So what do they hope? Have they said what they hope to get out of this?
Well, their names are Brandon and Tal, and they both have an interest in rebooting the news. One of them is actually a joint major in computer science and journalism, the first such creature I've come across.
See, this is what you're looking for, right?
This is what I'm looking for,
you're looking to create more of that, right?
Right. Yeah. And so I'm hoping that they're just the first wave of people. And the journalism students with more classical journalism backgrounds are so thrilled to have these students in the class with them. So it's starting to work, and your helping us out should really move the ball on that as well.
I hope so. That'd be interesting. Yeah.
All right. Well, people know that this is happening, and therefore, you're going to be doing a lot of things with NYU, we hope, in the months and year ahead. Let's move on.
Sure.
One of the biggest things that happened in the news world this week, probably bigger than anything, actually, was the announcement by the New York Times that they have set a direction for themselves on the big question of whether they want to be a pay site or a free site. And their announcement was a little odd, frankly. It was, first of all, not about what they're going to do right now, but what they're going to do in 2011.
Yeah, which makes it kind of a non-event.
Which makes it
it's kind of
a strange thing.
Well, if you were going to do it, why don't you just do it?
Right. And
that's what I'd like to
they
know.
Did. They said they aren't going to build a paywall exactly. They're going to build what's called a metered system. In a metered system, you get a certain number of visits, and then after that number is reached, you are asked to register and pay. So that if you want to continue to visit the Times, you would pay. But then, as I wrote at my own post on Postress, a different aspect came out, which is that if you arrive at NewYorkTimes.com by following a link from another site,
mm-hmm.
they won't count that against your total, and you won't have to pay. And in theory, at least, according to what they said so far, you can visit the New York Times any number of times, right, as long as you're coming through a link.
Well, you understand why they're doing that,
I
right?
I do. Yeah. Because they're trying to preserve the traffic from the open web.
Well, they want you to link to them.
And they want you to link to them. And they don't want to sync in search. And they want to kind of have an income stream from their most hardcore users. And they want the more lighter core users to have a kind of free entrance. So anyway.
It's nonsense. It's just, they'll come up with so many exceptions that, I mean, the fact that they need an exception is sort of a pretty good clue that they don't need a firewall, a paywall, that the paywall probably isn't something that they're comfortable with. They'll find that there are many other ways. This is also, by the way, a throwback to the way it used to work when the Times had a paywall for the editorial content.
Yeah, you know, for Times Select, yeah.
Yeah, I think Times Select was basically the op-ed columnists.
And it was, yeah.
Right, and so they realized that they were losing out to the political bloggers, the because nobody would point to the New York Times commentary, and so they added that exception then. It didn't work. I mean, basically, it's a communication issue more than anything. They have to somehow make the people that would be pointing to them believe that this loophole actually exists, and it's an awfully difficult thing to communicate. And it doesn't really stick. And aside from that, there's this suspicion on the part of people pointing in that it may not actually work the way they say it works, and it may not work that way forever. So if I point into one of these, I mean, you know, the idea is, okay, Jay, you're writing a blog post, and you want to write about this piece that some New York Times, some New York Times piece that's relevant to it. You're going to point to it because, my readers won't mind that because they won't be charged for it. But you have no guarantee that they're going to keep that policy in place for any period of time. So you probably won't link. Because rather than depend on them to maintain that for all time, go find an AP story that does what you want it to do. You know, it doesn't have to be in the New York Times.
Now, your view then is that they will have trouble communicating to bloggers and others that these links will actually work,
right,
and that people won't necessarily trust it even if they do communicate.
Right. It's too complicated. It's like there's open, and meaning that you can point, use the web, right? And then there's mishigas, the Yiddish word, which means an unholy mess, that nobody really understands. I mean, the fact that they have to come out with these after statements that say, well, we really would like to have this loophole, maybe this one. It's a bad idea.
So what does that tell you is going on there?
I think that we're seeing the internal process being exposed. I think we're...
You mean the internal divisions and struggles within the empire?
Theoretically, they've got the Mexican, what's his name?
Carlos Slim.
Slim, right. Okay, so let's just say for the sake of argument, he says, well, I own a big chunk of the New York Times, or I own a big debt. I don't forget. He has some financial...
He loaned them some money, essentially.
He basically has a say in the future of the newspaper, basically. And so he says to them, well, I'm not satisfied with the numbers that I'm seeing. We need to do something to make sure that, you're going to be able to pay back this loan at some point in the future. So I think we need to start charging for it. And the editorial people and, management people come back to him and say, well, but, we've thought this thing through. We don't really see how it's going to work. He says, no, well, the numbers really say this is what we got to do. And so they have to do something.
I don't know if it's him exactly.
No, I don't either, of course. Yeah. I said for just the sake of argument.
Right.
It could be Sulzberger. It could be, whatever. It could be anybody there.
Could be the journalists who are panicking.
I don't think it's Martin Niesenholtz, though. I think Martin pretty much...
Now, you know him, so why don't you think it's his idea?
Because he was arguing pretty strenuously against the paywall in the first incarnation of it. And I think that my sense of how he views things is that is more or less the way I view it, is that The Times is, I heard this somewhere in here, that they are the leading web-based news source or news organization in terms of traffic. I'm not saying it very well, but they're the leader, basically. If you're looking for news on the web, you're probably going to go to the New York Times, right? Well, that's a pretty good place to be, no matter how you look at it. That's probably where they want to be, right? And they probably want to do things to enhance that, not to subtract from it. Well, the paywall certainly does subtract
from
it. Well,
but maybe, let me go back a step. You worked out with Martin Nisenholtz a way for bloggers to link to the New York Times despite the fact that the archive policy meant that some articles would disappear behind an archive paywall, right?
You know, my memory isn't so good. I remember talking
I'm telling you, you did.
Oh, okay. All right, if you say so.
I used the system, the New York Times link generator.
Well, that wasn't mine, actually. The New York Times link generator. Oh. Right. Well, no, those links came out of RSS feeds. The link generator wasn't my software. It was somebody else's software.
But it was based on that loophole. The system.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Actually, it was a loophole for RSS. It meant if the link came out of an RSS feed, it meant that it didn't go through the paywall. Right.
Okay. Yeah. So he was trying to create a system that would enable bloggers and others to link to the New York Times despite the fact that they had this policy.
Right.
Okay. So he's doing that again.
No, I don't think he ever did that. He is doing that again, probably, but or somebody is because they know the history.
Right.
But I don't think that was what he wanted to do. I think that was you're seeing the Ouija board, you know, that a big organization, is and how it doesn't have a single mind on these sorts of things.
I agree with you there. In fact, Time Select as an episode was an example of that. Time Select was not so much a strategy about how to build revenue on the web. It was a political compromise between one camp that wanted to remain completely free, another camp that probably said we should become a pay site. They couldn't choose either direction because they didn't have the vision, the leadership they needed for that.
Right.
So they said, okay, well, we'll try it in this area. They knew that the columnists were in high demand, so it seemed plausible that people would pay for them.
Right.
But what they have said is the reason they dropped it was not that the columnists were dropping out of the public conversation, even though they were, and they weren't so happy about it, but rather that once they looked at the traffic coming in sideways from search, they realized that actually they were making money from Time Select. They met their targets. They had people who signed up.
Mm-hmm.
But it was actually less money than they would make from this huge amount of traffic that began coming to the New York Times, especially if they open their archives.
Ta-da! Hello. Maybe if, like, you just do what you do well and stop trying to play all these silly games, you might actually have a business that means something
to
people.
Well, that was then, and this is now.
I know, but it's like a big loop, right? It's not a loop of... They have to face up to the fact that they're in the technology business now. They don't get to fudge like this. You don't see the leading technology companies coming out. You never see the compromises in their products.
Mm.
I mean, when you do see the compromises in the products, they flop. And, you know, I mean, I can tell you that, I mean, the things, we don't even have to go into it. They do. The great products, the great technology products are the ones that have the clarity of a vision of usually an individual. Somebody is, Google is more of the consensus building type organization. If you use a Android phone, which I do, you'll see a lot of consensus in there and a lot of sort of this kind of thinking. Whereas you look at Apple, you know, it's totally not about consensus. There are designers at Apple and they design the products for better or worse. It's better, usually, much better to have a singular vision of, you know, some model that the whole thing conforms to than trying to satisfy, you know, it's not about satisfying the individual camps inside the company. What it's about is creating something that works in the market, right? I mean, and at the same time as fulfilling the news mission. I mean, you want to do both. And the same thing is true of Apple. They want to create a product that works in the market, and they want to create a product that satisfies the artistic vision of Steve Jobs, who is both a business person and a technologist and an aesthetic and a person of art, you know? And that's totally what's missing in this situation. Can I shift into the other side of it? Okay. So I was thinking about this whole thing, and I read an article written by Fred Wilson, who's a local New York venture capitalist. And Fred reran a piece that he wrote when the Times was merely contemplating. Now they've advanced the next thing.
Right.
Now they're just contemplating putting in a paywall. He wrote when they were contemplating putting in the paywall. And he said what they ought to do is monetize the audience. Okay. Mm-hmm. And this struck me as really interesting, even though I hate the term audience. I think that if you use the word audience to describe what's happening on the internet, then you don't understand what's happening on the internet.
You're talking to the person who wrote the people formerly known as the audience.
Thank you. Well, exactly. And and many other people as well.
Yeah.
And
it struck you as an interesting idea.
Monetize the audience is something actually I would like them to do for me. I would like to be able to run ads in the New York Times. Then I realized I can run ads in the New York Times, right? Theoretically. Yeah. I don't know how to run an ad in the New York Times.
Right.
If I called up the New York Times and said, hey, I'd like to run an ad, they'd tell me to go.
It wouldn't be a user-friendly system.
It totally would not
right.
be.
But you could do it.
Probably if I was really persistent and willing to spend a huge amount of money to do it. We should maybe try that as an exercise. Let's see if I can
Sure, if you got 25,000.
I do actually have 25. I'm renting an apartment in Manhattan, Jay. You got to know I have $25,000.
Well, then you could probably do it.
To anybody who's ever rented an apartment in New York, you know that that's not just a joke. It's a very sad joke. But what I say is let's make that a retail thing. Let's make that an everyday occurrence for people who have something that they want, an idea that they want to get exposure for. This is something the New York Times does a phenomenal job at, right? They do that extremely well. Exposure for ideas is what, in a way, is the business that they're in.
Right. No, public conversation.
They should sell that. There's your monetize the audience. How? There are a million ways. I mean, you know, if I'm looking at an article written by somebody who, you know, is saying something that I think is wrong and my blood pressure goes up and I say, man, that guy's wrong. I really want to say that guy's wrong and I really want everybody to hear me. Okay. Mm. I don't just want to post a comment underneath this thing and have all kinds of personal attacks. I want my idea to be not in the same space his is, but at the same level of prominence as his is, which is, after all, what an ad is, right? Mm-hmm. An ad, I'm not in their space. You can always tell the difference between an ad and an editorial. That's an absolute given, right?
Important.
Must be able to tell the difference.
Right.
But my idea is given equal prominence to theirs, and I pay for the privilege.
Uh-huh.
I pay for the privilege to do this.
We could even set up an auction for it.
Totally. Now, did you hear the key word in there? Was pay.
Pay.
What do I pay them? I pay them money.
Dollars.
Money. Business model.
Yeah.
We're talking business model here.
All right. So let me see if I understand this. Your example, which was interesting, was I'd pay to be able to put my ad next to David Carr's the next time he writes a media.
Cockamamie piece about the future of journalism.
Okay. That's your guy. I can imagine the space next to Maureen Dowd.
Oh, yeah, that would be prime space.
Right?
In other words, the more inane the commentary, the more value you create for the publisher.
You know, Mickey Kaus once had an idea. This is a hilarious idea he had at Slate. And it was similar to yours, except it was a little bit more sinister. And his idea was that if you had enough money, you could pay to not run Joe Klein's column. Right? Like you could pay Time Magazine to leave Joe Klein's column out. But that's censorship. We don't want to do that. Yeah.
We'll put him out there.
Yeah. So anyway, the space next to Maureen Dowd would be very valuable because a lot of people would want to talk back to her, and you could auction it. And actually,
it's not just talk back to her. Don't make it center around her.
Okay.
We want to talk to the same people.
Same
people she's talking to.
Right.
Right. Equal time.
Yeah,
right?
Equal time.
And we're willing to pay for it as well.
Right. With equal prominence, but different type of material.
Yeah. And unlike most of the wacky ideas I throw out there, all right, this one actually almost everybody really liked.
People got it.
Yeah. It was, hadn't even come up with the way of describing it as retail advertising.
Right. Okay?
But it wasn't even in there. And in fact, if you read the piece, you'd have to ask yourself, what exactly is the idea? Because I never really quite say it. That basically, because I say I can run ads right now.
Well, but, I didn't get it until you wrote that thing about David Carr. Like, if I could write an ad next to David Carr's column, then that would be really cool.
Right.
I got it.
Then. Right, yeah.
But you know why I like this idea is there's a certain school of thought that says the real product of the New York Times is not the news and the information. It's influence. And influence comes from having the news and having the the information,
right.
And so what the real value is in the prominence of the New York Times in public conversation,
right?
And if that is your actual product, then you would never put a paywall around it,
right?
Because
limit
the influence, right?
And it's against your interest to do that.
And it's against your interest to do that, and a particularly vivid example of this is for the columnist like Friedman. I mean, he must have hated Time Select, even though he went along with it.
Of course he did, right.
Because if you are a foreign affairs columnist,
right,
and the people in Egypt that you're writing about in your column can read it online,
right,
this gives you a completely different kind of influence
than
if six people in the ministry get the newspaper in the diplomatic pouch. You know what I mean? Yeah. And the whole idea of the Times as the worldwide news brand is actually quite close to becoming a reality. I mean, if you're the biggest source of news in the U.S., it's a short step.
And why would you
to becoming the biggest source of news
and
worldwide?
Why would you want to cut back in any way right now? Because you're about to win.
Well,
I mean, and that's the tragic part of this whole thing. I mean, it's this contradiction, and it's only because of lack of creativity that they're losing. It's only because their thinking has to be within a certain very defined set of parameters. There's another thing I want to add here that that led me to this idea that I did not put into the article is that I've put this in many other articles, is that ultimately what the Times and other newspapers have to do is they have to find a way to open the doors to let the members of their community go direct through them to each other. Mm-hmm. You know, Cody Brown wrote a wonderful piece about this a few months back. He was going back to the early days of the American Republic, where that was the understanding was that the news industry or news organizations, I think it was in the charter of the New York Times is what he was quoting. They said basically all we're doing is reflecting the conversation that's taking place. We're just, you know, showing you what's actually being said. And that's it. That's the only role. It's this whole level of transparency that they seem to have completely lost this idea that they need to be that. So they've rejected that for now, at least, this idea that we need to be able to get the sources into the newspaper or news flow going direct. This is a first step down that path. In other words, you're not willing to use your editorial judgment to decide which sources should be present in your newspaper. Let's take a first step down that path, which is, okay, we'll self-select. We'll decide based on who's willing to pay. We will show you that this can be a really profitable business to be in, you know, this idea of carrying our ideas. And then it'll be in the next iteration, it'll be completely obvious to you and everybody else that the next thing to do is to start opening up the door on the other side of the. In other words, you've got
opening the door on the other side. What
I mean,
that mean,
OK, so you draw a line down the middle of the hypothetical newspaper page. Mm-hmm. OK, on the left hand side is Maureen Dowd and David Carr and David Brooks and Paul Krugman and Thomas Friedman
and a thousand beat writers.
Matt Richtel
and
John
Matthew Marco. Wald, who's the transportation safety reporter.
Right. And Brian Stelter. Let's get some more plugs in there. Right. You know, for all these great people get the left hand side and we get the right hand side. We have to pay to be on the right-hand side. They get paid to be on the left-hand side. Mm-hmm. That's the way this works, okay? Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like we're coddling them in a way and say, you know, okay, you can have it your way. You'll get paid to do this, and we'll pay to do this over here. But in the back of my mind, I'm thinking that, okay, once you're making all this money, Now we're going to probably be asking you to say, okay, can we get some of these really great writers over here who may not have a whole lot of money, but are willing to take, now they're willing to write for free over here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know they hate that idea, okay? Get ready, because if they're willing to pay, okay, to be over here on the right-hand side, you got to figure some of them are willing to not pay to be on the left-hand side, but also not to be paid. The problem for the whole picture for the news industry is that the salaries are in danger.
Yeah.
You can't ignore that fact. It's
That's
a fact.
That's right. And that is one thing that has led them to this metered system, because the revenues from the print product right now are sustaining the enterprise.
Right.
And
but we have to realize
revenues don't necessarily have a future.
Yes, but we have to realize that they're saving their jobs, not the news. That's what they're doing. That's the distinction. The news doesn't need them to do that.
Well, see, this is where the argument lies.
I know.
Yeah.
This is my job to say these things, because somebody's got to say them. You know?
Right.
This is why they hate me, you know?
Well, let's not say it that strongly.
Well, some do. Certain editor in never mind.
Well, never mind, yeah.
Let's not go there.
Well, let's move on
to
another theme that actually has resurfaced and has been a constant with us on Rebooting the News, and that is Twitter's suggested user list.
Oh, yeah.
An unexpected development.
Yeah, isn't that fun? You and I both, we're like heroes of the revolution, Jay, you and me. Yeah.
Well, let's tell people what happened. The
He wants to be closer to the mic.
Yeah.
I'm relaxed. What do you want? All right, here, I'll move the mic closer to me. By the way, how much time do we have left? We only have 10 minutes left. It says 18 here.
Oh, this is wrong.
This is wrong.
Okay.
How are we going to know when we're getting really close? No, but when will you signal us? Give me a big signal 2 minutes before. Okay.
Okay, so Twitter suggested user lists, which we have analyzed repeatedly on this show, suddenly disappeared in favor of a new system. And the new system was based sort of on interests, right?
Maybe.
Technology, yeah. Sports, entertainment, news. And then they suggested users within those interests, which is a little bit less arbitrary than out of the blue, here are 20 suggested people to follow. A little bit.
I'm not sure I agree, but go ahead.
And they, in any case, they did junk the old suggested users list. And suddenly your name appeared on the tech.
No, not on the tech.
Under what was it?
Under something, our picks. In other words, Twitter corporate picks or something.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah, not under tech. Isn't that interesting? No,
yeah.
It wasn't under tech.
So you were under the Twitter team's own personal picks, sort of like the staff at the bookstore saying our favorites or something.
Can you see I'm rolling my eyes as you say that? This is like multimedia. Jay can see I was rolling my eyes.
Yeah.
The rest of you can't see that.
Eye roll, a universal symbol for eye roll. All right, so what happened then?
Well, first of all, I don't think it really was any great big difference. It's somehow almost everybody who was on the old list was on the new list. So they're categorized. They added a few more people. They claim that it's algorithmic. And I think this is like unbelievable, just unbelievable, just so unbelievable that it's just can't be believed. I mean, how could the algorithm spit out exactly the same names that the by-hand method did? I mean, and how could it not spit out certain names like Loic Lemur or Undertech or Robert Scoble or Jason Calacanis? How could it be that those people don't get spit out?
Mm.
You know, it's a little bit beyond belief, but so I don't believe it. And I took 24 hours, roughly, to make up my mind about what I wanted to do there, because there was a little curveball in there, because they were saying this is not the suggested user list. And in one way, it's not, because the new users don't automatically get subscribed to 20 of these people. So so it doesn't have it doesn't get you all the followers that the old list used to be. But I just You know, there was no way. I had been saying to so many people who were on the list that the only honorable thing to do would be to be request that you be taken off of it. And having said that, and having believed it, and then finding that the next day, I really did find myself more inclined to withhold criticism of Twitter. Mm-hmm. Not because I feared that they would take me off the list, but because I had a warm feeling about them. You know, recognition. Approval is a very, very, very powerful tool in interpersonal relations. If I say, Jay Rosen is a really fantastic person, my guess is that if you're built like most people are, you're going to be more reluctant to personally criticize me later. You might stop and think that, well, you know, he's a pretty good guy. And you might actually feel that way because it feels really good to get that approval. Mm-hmm. So, and then another, I had another insight too, which is that it must feel pretty good on their side to have the ability to convey that approval, you know, that have that power to approve or not approve is would be a very hard thing to give up if you had it.
Yeah.
Right. And they managed to have it and get away with it and not really get roasted too bad on it. So I don't think they gave it up. And so given that, I had to say, please take me off the list. And
they how did you do that? How did you communicate?
I did two things. First, I sent an email to Fred Wilson, who is the board member at Twitter. And I posted a copy of that email to my blog, Scripting News. And Fred, I don't think Fred forwarded the email to anybody at the team. So I think it was my blog post that got me taken off the list, which is... You know, a part of me says, geez, Dave, you know, wouldn't it have been nice to be on that list? Everybody could say, you know, we saw that you were on that list. You must be like some really hot person, you know. Well, you know, I'll have to find another way to get my satisfaction. And I was so proud of you when you asked to be and, you know, to be removed from the list. I couldn't not do that. I felt this is an important thing. So
we have one difference of emphasis on this question, which is I wouldn't say to others that they're corrupted by being on the list. I would just let them do their own thing and I would do my thing. And I don't really see it as inherently corrupting. I see it as an individual decision that people need to make. And most people don't make any decision at all. They just accept it, of course. But I don't think I would go that far.
Okay. Well, we
but
we
there's
do it
where
differently.
We have a
yeah, there's a
difference.
Yeah. No, I feel that it does taint the integrity of somebody. If you had not asked to be removed from the list, we might not be doing this podcast now, okay? Honestly, that, you know, I didn't tell you what to do, okay? And I never did issue an ultimatum to you, right? I do not do that. Ultimatum is not something I believe in. But on the other hand, it felt like crap that you were on that list.
I know you feel very strongly about
it. I do. So, yeah. And like, you know, what can you do if you have, if it's not just that I feel very strongly about it. It's, take Anil Dash, for example. I mean, he is, he's carved out a really big mission for himself, right?
And he has an important job.
Right. Well, now, if you're in a position to, like, do work on behalf of the federal government, you really can't be on the suggested user list. Why? Because you're now receiving something of value from a vendor. The other vendors aren't going to accept your neutrality on this, right? And that he has not withdrawn from it is an amazing thing to me. That it tells me that I don't think he's parsing it correctly. I think that every news organization that's on that list has a problem too. So,
all right.
Yeah.
Let me just bring up one thing I noticed today that really interested me as a sort of a sign of the new system of news. See if you have any comment on it. The Education Writers Association, which is all the people who cover education in the United States, decided that it was essentially in crisis. And the reason that it's in crisis is the same reason that all the religion reporters are in crisis and the science reporters are in crisis, which is that the newspapers are shedding the people who had this beat. And they once could look forward to a career in covering education. Mm-hmm. And now Most of those jobs are disappearing. They're not being replaced.
Mm.
So they sort of face this question of, well, what's our association for if we're kind of being shed from the industry that once employed us? And they decided to do something really interesting. They decided to move from a closed membership organization where you have to be an education writer to be part of our group to a kind of an open-sourced, online-based community, which would include not only the people who cover education, but the people who care about education
right.
and how it is covered. And they're evolving from what it was essentially a professional club
right.
to a community of concern. And they hope to survive and gain a new role in interesting everybody in the problem of how do we communicate the problems of education to the people who care about them? How do we get good information about our schools? How do we get the kind of public debate about education that we need? And nobody really cares all that much except people in the profession about these professional associations. Most people wouldn't even know about them. I do because I'm a professor of journalism.
Right.
But I think it's a perfect little illustration of where the new system is going now, from closed to open, from professional fraternity to community of concern, from our little club to this concerns us all, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's strength in that approach, even though they're also losing something.
That makes perfect sense. Just fell out, right? It's almost like you reach that point where you no longer have the purpose, the original purpose for forming the organization is no longer relevant, right? So find some new relevance. The subject is relevant, you know. Providing information and news and perspectives on the education system is, you know, one of the fundamental pillars of, like, the future of our civilization.
And news.
There's
not going to be any less news.
That's for sure.
Right.
Right. Exactly. That's an important point. The
yeah.
news, you know, you tend to think, yeah, no, absolutely true.
Wednesday,
right.
There's going to be a big announcement. People
yes.
in Silicon Valley especially will be paying a lot of attention to. I think it's going to be in San Francisco, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, that we know for sure. It's
yeah.
going to be in San Francisco.
And Apple is going to announce what most people are calling a tablet.
Well, that we don't know. We have to be really clear about what we know and don't know. We don't know
that. We don't
that.
Know exactly what they're going to announce.
But they've been leaking like crazy.
Yes.
Which is very unusual for Apple. So, they've been leaking in not just factual leaks, but superlative leaks as well in terms of the size and order, the magnitude of this.
Yeah, a lot has, right. Well, I've been kind of exempting myself from this,
sure.
on the principle of market differentiation because everybody's talking about it. So I have not talked about it. But you have some.
With 2 minutes.
Yeah.
This is going to be tough. All right. Here's what we think we know. It's a tablet computer. It runs iPhone apps. There probably will be a new release of the iPhone that comes with it. It'll probably either not be AT&T or not only be AT&T. It might be Verizon,
right.
Might be T-Mobile, might be something else entirely.
Which could be big news.
I'll tell you what, in terms of links that I've pushed in the last month, that one got the most traffic. People are very, very interested in AT&T going away.
I am interested in that part.
Yeah. And one that hasn't really been discussed very much, which I think pretty much is a foregone conclusion, is that Apple is going to have a cloud. And the cloud is going to be their answer to Google. And they're going to tie all these devices together through that cloud. And you're going to find that there are going to be all kinds of new communication capabilities that they've invented privately and quietly in their labs that we'll demo extremely well. Whether we actually want to use them, whether we can actually stand to even think about them because they're so closed and they're so self-serving to Apple or they, you know, whatever. Another important thing is, try to sneak this in, is that it's probably going to have very material effect. Well, we don't, by the way, that end is not hard. So we can stop now at this point. Okay. What was I going to say? Oh, yes, it will have profound effects on the magazine business and on the news business, in that it will, they're going to try to create a new distribution system for those things. The Kindle will also go away, too.
Hmm.
This is another